North Carolina Reading Service for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners now presents The Independent. Independent, your weekly guide to local in-depth news features and events, and theindieweek.com is read to you by John Fetterson, and today's issue, dated July 17th of 2025. Fade our music down and we'll get going. And before we begin the regular articles, Indy has written an article about itself because it's award season in the journalism world, and we recently won a few accolades. The staff earned 6 awards from the North Carolina Press Association. Chloe Courtney Bowles' dogged reporting on financial and mismanagement at Raleigh HBCU St. Augustine's University was part of a package of stories by Indy and the Assembly that took home the first place Duke University Green Rossiter Award for distinguished newspaper work in higher education reporting. Another Assembly collaboration, co-authored by Justin Laidlaw, took first place for city, county, and government reporting. That looked at the adoption of gunshot detection technology across the state, including Durham, and whether it really works. Chase Pellegrini DePar won first place in the news feature writing category for his not-so-serious dispatch from Flagstop, a rager for Chapel Hill fraternity brothers who became MAGA darlings after they held up an American flag during a pro-Palestine protest at UNC last year. Lena Geller won third place in the Beat feature reporting category for a package of Durham food and dining stories. Other authors, Angelica Edwards, Nicole Moore, and there were creative directors Nicole Moore and former graphic designer Ann Salmon took first place in the Green Eyeshade Award cover design. They are a print and online journal, of course. Lena Geller, second place in food and dining, and culture editor Sarah Edwards. And finally, Lena Geller, again, an honorable mention in the 2025 AAN Awards food writing category. And I've just summarized these awards, and we're going to pat ourselves on the back. And here's one from John Fetterson, and my job is just to read the stories to you. So here we go on with our regular articles. Well, first, from St. Augustine's University, they have lost their accreditation from the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, we'll just call them SACS, following a binding arbitration process, an outcome that feels almost inevitable after years of instability and the internal discord at the historically black and college and university. For the past several years, SAU has been plagued by declining enrollment, snowballing debts totaling in the tens of millions of dollars, and calls from alumni and former trustees to replace its top leaders. Earlier this year, Indy and the Assembly reported that the NC Attorney General's office is investigating the university over allegations related to its board of trustees. The current board chair, Brian Bulwar, recently admitted to a decade's worth of alleged financial mismanagement at the school, including alleged misuse of federal funds. On top of all its pre-existing issues, loss of the accreditation cuts off SAU's access to federal financial aid and makes its degrees almost worthless to prospective students. Despite evidence to the contrary, SAU's leaders claimed in a press release on Monday that they expect to regain accreditation and recover financially. They plan to file an injunction to prevent the decision from taking effect. It estimates this litigation will cost $1 million, including a retainer fee of $350,000, for which it will need to fundraise. The press release did not explain the supposed grounds for the injunction, and a spokesperson did not immediately return a request for comment. Although SAU has been placed on probation and lost accreditation before, It always had it restored. This time is different and more permanent. It's the first time SACS has revoked an accreditation after going through the final and binding arbitration, which it introduced in 2020. The accreditor did not immediately respond for a request for comment. Robert Kelchin, a higher education researcher based at University of Tennessee, Knoxville, wrote in an email to Indy, "I'm not surprised that the appeal was unsuccessful, given that financial metrics and accreditation standards tend to be pretty clear-cut. Lawsuits to retain accreditation are rarely successful for the same reason." Kelchin suspects that behind the scenes, SAU had been contemplating a switch from SACCOC to the Transnational Association of Christian Colleges and Schools, TRACS, for some time. But TRACS requires its schools to demonstrate financial stability. Kelchin wrote, "If SAU is consistently losing money, they are unlikely to meet the standards." The university said in that Monday press release it will open for virtual instruction in the fall of this year, with course offerings available traditional and adult learners, particularly in the Raleigh community. They graduated 25 students in May, and the school's total enrollment is estimated to be very low. A university spokesperson recently declined to provide Indy with the latest enrollment figures or say how many new students applied this year. In the press release, University President Marcus Burgess wrote, quote, "Our priority now is to ensure every student can complete their education at SAU with an accredited degree in hand, and we have a clear plan to make that happen." The release hinted that SAU has secured, quote, "a major partnership that will leverage SAU's valuable real estate assets through a long-term lease, which could clear SAU's existing debts and fund new investments." The university claims to be finalizing the agreement, with more details to come soon. It has made similar promises before, teasing lucrative development deals with Carter in 2023 and 50+1 sports in 2024, but both agreements fell apart before they could be finalized. Benjamin Johnson is an SAU alumnus and a leader of Save SAU, the alumni organization that sued the university in 2024 in an attempt to replace the Board of Trustees. He's not surprised by SAC's decision and says SAU's only path forward is under new leadership. Johnson says, "We can bring funding opportunities to the school if current and former board chairs Boulware and James Perry are removed." He adds, "Personally, I don't think that the alumni members will respond positively to raising money for litigation. If things were done correctly 18 months ago, you wouldn't have to ask alumni to raise money for litigation." Next, Chloe Courtney Bowl writes, "The Raleigh City Council members say they will support a future affordable housing bond." 1,000 people gathered at Watts Chapel Missionary Baptist Church in Raleigh on Saturday to ask the City Council one question: did you keep your campaign promises on affordable housing? The sanctuary was filled to the brim with members of One Wake, a coalition of 40 religious congregations from around the county. More people spilled onto two overflow rooms to watch a live stream of the event. At the front of the sanctuary, near the pulpit, sat a jumbo-sized prop report card waiting to be filled out. Last October, several of the council's 8 current members and many of their then opponents gathered at that same church before a similarly large and expectant crowd. At One Wake's invitation, they publicly committed to increasing the city's affordable housing budget from $30 million to $70 million and reserving 100 acres of public land for new affordable housing units if elected. Their promises felt urgent and refreshingly concrete in the face of Wake County's staggering 60,000-unit housing shortage. 6 months into their term, the council members returned, minus Jane Harrison, who is out of town, with some good news and some bad news. Raleigh's affordable housing funding did not increase to $70 million in the city's most recent budget cycle, but it didn't decrease either, which counts for something, argued the council members. Jonathan Lambert Melton explained, this budget cycle, the budget did increase slightly. We budgeted a little more conservatively given what's going on in the world and the nation. I will say, where most departments were asked to cut things and to constrict, the affordable housing budget did not do that. We are committed to expanding affordable housing. The council did not set aside a significant amount of public land for affordable units, although some of them, along with 1 week's leaders, want to see some of the 415-acre Raleigh tract in southeast Raleigh, which is owned jointly by the city and county, redeveloped for affordable housing. After those lukewarm updates, the most exciting moment of the day came when Reverend Paul Anderson, pastor of the Fountain of Raleigh Fellowship, stood at the podium and asked the council members one by one if they would support a new bond referendum to fund affordable housing. They each said they would, eliciting cheers and applause from the crowd. But while a few of the council members, Lambert Melton, Megan Patton, and Christina Jones, specified they would support a $200 million bond, Mayor Janet Cowell and council members Stormy Forte, Mitchell Silver, and Corey Brantz were more circumspect about the dollar amount. Harrison, the last council member, wrote on her website Monday that she supports 1 week's affordable housing goals and will recommend the $200 million bond. Due to a quirk in the state's public meeting laws, the presence of a quorum of city council members in one place, even a church, on a Saturday during their summer hiatus constitutes an official meeting and must be publicized so that anyone can attend. Since this event was not publicized, the city council members had to separate into two groups to avoid a quorum. This meant that Mayor Janet Cowell and council members Lambert Melton, Mitchell Silver, and Corey Brantz took the stage to answer 1 week's questions first, then exit the room. Only then could the members Stormy Forte, Megan Patton, and Jones enter and take their turn in the hot seat. During the transition, the 900 congregants in the sanctuary stood, held hands, and sang, "We Shall Overcome." The bifurcation of the event produced some telling moments. 1 week leaders asked the first group if they would support an affordable housing bond. Generally, they all said yes. Then 1 week clarified they wanted a $200 million bond. Would the council support that? Lambert Melton was the only member of his group to stick to his original yes. When Cowell said no, the crowd shuddered with disappointment. The mayor said, "To commit to an actual number is just something we are not able to do." She and the city manager have already begun planning for the 2026 bond measure, which she expects will be significantly more than $80 million. That's the amount of the city's last affordable housing bond passed in 2020. 1 week leaders pointed out that Raleigh voters overwhelmingly approved a $275 million parks bond in 22. Lisa Yebow, the lead pastor at Southeast Raleigh Table, a member of 1 week, told Indy after the event, "I'm grateful we're able to have these tension points in this space, knowing that we're going to continue to work versus wringing our hands at home." Reverend Donna Coltrane Battle added, "We will continue to press them where they said no, and continue to also work with them and imagine with them in ways that we can turn that no into a yes." Well, we're going everywhere in this early portion of the Indy Week broadcast. This about the North Carolina's renewable energy industry, and the budget bill has hit it. When Bouviet Solar opened a new factory in Greenville this year, Will Etheridge, owner and CEO of Raleigh's Southern Energy Management, was excited for his company to buy solar panels built in North Carolina and install them on North Carolina homes and businesses. Etheridge, who is from eastern North Carolina, called it an American success story in one of the most business-friendly states in the country. Then, President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill changed everything, Etheridge told a round table hosted by Representative Deborah Ross in Garner last week. We switched from planning for expansion to planning for job protection and layoffs. Now I'm going to be laying off North Carolinians. That's because Trump's sweeping domestic policy bill guts the tax credit programs the Democrats muscled through in the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act. That act paid 30% of renewable energy-related homeowner expenditures, including installation of solar panels, solar water heaters, and related battery storage technology, provided a tax credit for builders of energy-efficient homes, and tax incentives for investments in clean energy. These provisions were set to continue through 2034, making renewable energy a pretty attractive industry for investors, and a vast majority of those investments were in red districts. It's easy to tune out some sweeping numbers. The Clean Investment Monitor estimates that 18,000 North Carolinians work in operational and construction jobs created as a result of energy and manufacturing investments, with 20,000 potential jobs based on planned investments. But it's harder to ignore the impact on individual North Carolina companies. That residential solar tax credit, said Max Abili, executive director of NC Sustainable Energy Association, quote, supports probably 50% of our total business and employment. He pointed out that North Carolina is number one in the country for rural clean energy jobs. While Democrats like Ross have openly railed against the bill, the Raleigh area representative calls it the Big Ugly Bill, business owners were gentler in lobbying legislators like Senator Tom Tillis to try to soften the impact by phasing out the energy provisions over time. Etheridge told Indy after that event, we knew the writing was on the wall, but instead of having any kind of multi-year phase down, which would let the market and our teams adjust and prevent a lot of job loss and investment loss, we got a cliff at the end of this year. Tillis ultimately voted against the bill, but he didn't or couldn't help with that cliff. Ted Budd, North Carolina's other senator, voted for. Shastin Jolly manages the Green Tech Renewables branch in Garner. Jolly's 70,000-square-foot warehouse just next to Amazon's RDU1 warehouse on Jones Sausage Road is stocked with solar panels, inverters, and electrical components that Green Tech sells to companies like Etheridge's. Jolly told Indy that Republican legislators might not fully understand the utility of renewable energy at a time when data centers and AI server farms have helped push the American thirst for energy to all-time highs, and Jolly said. Solar and renewables are the quickest way to deploy, the cheapest way to deploy, new electrons to the grid. I think back in the olden days of solar and renewable energy, it was a very hippie, liberal movement about carbon reduction and climate change. And although it does help offset carbon, it's so much bigger than that now. This is an economics play. This is a manufacturing play. This is grid resilience and energy independence. The rollback is obviously a failure for Democrats like Ross, who hoped that landmark legislation like that Inflation Reduction Act would help them hold the presidency in 2024. Now, they're openly admitting they didn't really communicate its impact to the American people. Tampa-era Congresswoman Kathy Castor said, "It had a funny name, right? It didn't really convey. It was the single largest investment in clean energy and community resilience in history, bigger than anything any other country in the world had done." In response to an Indy question, Ross said, "We're working really hard on being better messengers. We're not great because we always speak in paragraphs and want to qualify everything, but we're getting better." Well, meanwhile, North Carolina businesses will be scrambling to figure out how to survive after the sudden policy change. Etheridge told Indy, "It's about, for me, the jobs, the skills, and the people, and how we help them grow. And I think that's obviously bipartisan." Well, next, over to Durham. And Durham Public Schools could lose $3 million due to a Trump administration freeze on K-12 grant money. On June 30, Trump administration sent a brief note to inform states that grants totaling $6.8 billion and $165 million for North Carolina alone would not be paid out as scheduled. On Monday, North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson announced 24 states are suing the Department of Education to get those funds back. Jackson said Congress created these programs, referring to those programs that fall under Title II, III, and IV. It authorized funding for these programs. The Department of Education does not have the authority to now withhold those funds. Well, folks, I'm reading this to you on Thursday, and we just heard that, in fact, the Supreme Court has allowed the administration to essentially deprive the whole Department of Education from any support from the government. So they're going to be laying off a lot of people in Washington in that behalf. Well, a report from the North Carolina Justice Center continues. This article found that rural schools will suffer the greatest loss of per-student funding. Still, the Triangle's urban district will feel a significant impact if the funds stay frozen. That $3 million for DPS includes almost $700,000 for support for English language learners, $1.3 million for teacher and professional development, and $900,000 for student support and academic enrichment. Wake County, per the Department of Public Instruction, stands to lose $8 million. Chapel Hill Carborough, $500,000, and Orange County, $375,000. Durham Public Schools have not received additional information about this freeze, said a spokesperson to Indy. This funding impacts teacher training, leadership development, and other evidence-based job-embedded professional learning that supports and advances student learning. $3 million is not a huge portion of the roughly $700 million DPS annual budget, but recent local fights over funding show that every dollar counts in the zero-sum game of school budgeting. For example, the district will pay $6 million more this year just to keep the lights on and maintain the same level of services. $3 million more in the budget would be enough to fund the district's expansion budget wish list, including higher pay for teachers, bus drivers, special ed staff, and workers with master's degrees. DPS will have to cut programs or find money elsewhere in the budget to pay for them. Jackson and other attorneys general are asking for an emergency injunction to lift the freeze. Quote, "We're going to try and resolve this as fast as possible so you can all get back to what you need to be doing, which is focused on having a successful school year. We need this to be resolved within a matter of weeks." Now over to the Urban Ministries of Durham, which itself is weathering funding cuts. The largest public homeless shelter serving Durham is facing financial headwinds, but the director of UMD says services will continue and may even expand. Last month, they lost two federal grants, one from FEMA and one from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The loss of the grants, combined with other economic pressures like the rising cost of ingredients and a decrease in donations, forced the shelter to cut the budget by 10% and lay off 7 full and part-time employees. Roughly 40 people remain employed by UMD, and services are not being cut, according to Executive Director Sheldon Mitchell. He says, "We're still here, able to provide services. We definitely are looking to and have to sort of realign some duties and activities for folks who are no longer with us to be able to do that. We are definitely looking to extend our net and our networks to gain new support, to hopefully encourage others that might want us to support us in a bigger way." UMD regularly works with 4,000 volunteers to serve around 6,000 people in the Durham area with housing, food, and other services. According to the organization, 118 people ended their homelessness by accessing these services. The federal grants UMD lost are worth nearly $60,000 and were used for the purchase of food served or distributed through UMD's community cafe and food pantry. Coupled with the rising cost of pantry staples like eggs and coffee, the loss of the grants puts strain on the organization at a time when more community members need to access services. UMD has seen an 11% increase in people eating meals at the shelter, and in the last couple weeks there have been around 140 single adults and over 70 families on UMD's waiting lists looking for shelter. Mitchell says, "We know the need is still there. We see the people that show up for the meals. Those numbers remain elevated, so we try to do, you know, the best we can, really, to maintain those core services, while we can look at how we can reduce costs and manage around those things." Amid this perfect storm of financial factors, fundraising is also down at UMD. A recent fundraising drive pulled in $100,000 less than last year, according to Mitchell. And giving has been down overall since the COVID lockdown, when there was a major influx of donations. Mitchell said, "This has really the first time we've seen a significant reduction in funding coming into the organization. During the pandemic, of course, there was a lot of funding. People were very charitable because everybody wanted to do something or be able to make a difference. And then now, you know, coming in a couple of years after the pandemic, we've seen those levels continue to decline." And he said he has not experienced similar circumstances in his 9 years with UMD. Despite the funding struggles, Mitchell said UMD is optimistic about potential growth. He presented in May to the Durham County Board of Commissioners about expanding services in a multi-floor building for the community's homeless population. He says, "We call it a community impact project, really looking at the housing, homeless housing system, you know. UMD would just happen to be one of the primary partners or players in that. Once that's finished, I think that's going to provide some direction or for timing, what's needed or what gets prioritized." Mitchell said that these concerns surrounding funding and the demand for emergency services will likely be felt by other organizations and food banks as well, and that funding cuts to USAID and other federal funding is already indirectly hurting UMD by hurting its partners. He said, "That's been a greater impact to us because those companies also sponsored our events, provided support to our organization as community corporate citizens, and now, you know, we no longer receive that support. A little more news about Chantal, that tropical storm, Chantal. Record flooding damages the Eno River State Park. Ryan Furman, executive director of the Eno River Association, ERA, planned to have a slow morning on Monday. The 46th annual festival on the Eno was just 2 days prior at West Point on the Eno, and staff were still recovering from that raucous weekend. He woke up, Furman did, to a fairly typical work text, he says. He left his phone at home when he and his wife set out to walk their dog in the neighborhood. When they arrived back 1 hour later, Furman's phone was overrun with messages from staff and concerned residents. He says, "We got about as nice as weather gets in early July in Durham. We felt like we dodged a bullet with that rain hitting on Sunday, and that feeling very quickly faded away as we realized the impacts of Chantal. That tropical storm brought historic levels of rainfall and massive flooding ripping through areas of Durham and Orange County overnight on Sunday. News of the devastation quickly spread as residents took stock of the collective damage done to their homes and neighborhoods. Circulating on social media was a photo of an almost fully submerged sign that read, "The Eno River rose to the level of this signpost, but ironically was cut off." The full sign would continue to say, "During Hurricane Fran in 1996. And Furman says, "I didn't for 1 second think the flooding could possibly be worse than Fran. That is the literal high water mark." A similar sign is posted at the Swinging Bridge near the Fuse Ford access point at Eno River State Park. That pedestrian bridge is one of the more recognizable landmarks at the state park and was underwater for nearly 2 days. Furman says a structural engineer will have to access that structure to determine whether it's salvageable or will have to be completely rebuilt. Around midnight on Sunday, the Eno River reached about 25.6 feet, exceeding what the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration categorizes as major flooding conditions. The previous record, instead of 25.6, was 23.6 feet during Hurricane Fran. Water flow, which denotes how much water moves past a specific point, averages about 300ths of a, to 700ths a kilo cubic feet per second, KCFS. Right before dawn, Monday, the Eno peaked at roughly 15.5 KCFS, about 500 times more water flow than normal. Furman says, "For that storm to cause flooding beyond Fran is kind of a wake-up call for us and for a lot of folks in the community, and especially coming on the heels of what we saw in Texas. I'm deeply concerned that this is not an anomaly anymore. These are not 100-year storms. They might be 5 or 10-year storms." Large trees were completely uprooted, flattened along the riverbank. Weaker, less mature trees couldn't resist the force of that torrential stream and were pulled into the river. Around, along with all manner of woodland debris, they got sucked in from the shore by the wax and wane of water levels, leaving behind dead fish. Damage to the Eno Creek lift station caused 5.8 million gallons of wastewater to spill into the Eno River, according to the city of Durham. The Eno River is about 40 miles long and eventually connects with the Little River and Flat River at Falls Lake. Access points to the state park were closed down by Monday afternoon and remained closed through Friday as the association, the State Park and Durham Parks and Rec Department assessed the total damage and organized cleanup efforts. Furman says returning the park to normal will likely take weeks. The Eno River Association was originally established in 1966. Over the decades, environmentalists and other advocates have worked alongside and sometimes in opposition of state and local government officials to steward those 4,300 acres that are now part of the state park. In 2022, the Indy reported on the potential construction of a 60-acre housing development near West Point on the Eno. Neighbors in northern Durham and members of the association strongly opposed the project, saying the development would cause water quality issues and damage to the watershed from stormwater runoff, citing the City of Durham's 2018 Eno River Watershed Improvement Plan. Furman applauds the work locals officials have done to implement strategies like building riparian buffers around the river and including more stringent rules for stormwater mitigation within the development code, and says these efforts helped reduce the amount of damage done by the storm, but the harm to nearby neighborhoods still cannot be understated. I think that word should be overstated. Folks in neighboring communities like Old Farm and River Forest are also looking at weeks, possibly months, of rehabilitation. The likelihood of some families, many of them Black and Hispanic, returning to their homes following the cleanup efforts is slim. Furman says the state and local governments may need to go a step further and consider strategic retreat from vulnerable areas that are prone to flooding. He says, around creeks, streams, and rivers, we have to anticipate that these things are going to continue to happen. And certainly any areas that are in an identified flood plain, we shouldn't be building anything. Furman worked for decades in affordable housing and homelessness services at Genesis Home, Families Moving Forward, and North Carolina Coalition to End Homelessness before he joined the Eno River Association as executive director earlier this year. And he said, because many of those folks are going to rebuild those homes, and the unfortunate reality is they are incredibly likely to flood again, even within the next 5 years. At West Point on the Eno, where Eno Fest was held July 4 and 5, leftover festival materials were tossed around the park grounds. Brian Eiler, the festival director, says, quote, the kind of debris you don't want washing down a river. Coolers, pop-up tents, folding tables, porta-potties, and Texas tankers were swept away by the storm. Eiler and other staff spent Monday afternoon wading through the muddy aftermath, trying to recover as much as they could. And he reflected, it's really just an exhaustive recognition standing here looking at the carnage. Staff did manage to pack up staging and audio equipment on Saturday after the festival concluded and planned to recover those additional materials on Sunday. The expected rainfall from Chantal was about 4 inches. And early signs pointed to most of the precipitation falling on either side of the triangle. Eiler says, even though we were exhausted, we would have relocated all that stuff to higher ground if we would have had warning and known that it was coming. I don't know if that has to do with cuts in the National Meteorology Service or just a natural phenomenon that came on so quickly. In past years, you're getting reports about this kind of potential impact 4 or 5 days in advance, and that most certainly did not happen with this. Despite the fallout from the storm, Eiler is still riding high from the weekend's festivities, which he called wildly successful. Over 20,000 people passed through West Point on the Eno, topping last year's attendance. He doesn't mind wading through the muck and grime that, quote, smells like a pig farm, given the circumstances, he says. I could be upset and bummed about what we're dealing with now and the bills that are going to result, but in the end, all that really matters is bringing everyone together, especially in these trying political times, and kind of reminding all those people that you are not alone. finally, if folks are interested in volunteering with Eno River Association, they will be posting to their website and social media pages with opportunities on how you could get involved. Not only there, but other organizations are also looking for volunteers to support cleanup efforts and support neighbors in need. Well, that's about a half an hour of reading or more of reading grim things, and let's move on to something that gives me a little bit of a smile. Concrete Chorus records the warblers, wrens, and wood thrushes of Durham. On Sundays and Mondays between 6 and 9 a.m., most Durham residents are snoozing their alarms, brewing coffee, and skimming their inboxes. Meanwhile, at unmarked locations across the city, 30 dedicated volunteers raise their phones towards roofs and treetops, searching for the warblers behind the morning's sidewalk serenades. Gabrielle Bonnell, a 26-year-old bookstore clerk, says, "I've recently got to birding in my old age. The morning air is thick but mild, its humidity not yet oppressive," as she stands peering up at a thicket of sycamores and sweet gum trees lining a walking trail near Briar Creek. A steady whir of chirps and chitters bounces back and forth between the branches. Behind Bunnell, a great blue heron alights on the glassy surface of a small pond, extending its impressive black-tipped wings and spindly yellow legs. For Bunnell and many other participants in the Concrete Chorus project, birding is both a hobby and an opportunity to contribute to conservation science. Founded by ecological researcher and former North Carolina resident Bradley Alf, A-L-L-F, the project investigates what makes birds thrive in cities. The study examines where different bird species nest in Durham to better understand how social and ecological factors shape biodiversity. In the future, Alf hopes to expand to major American cities, saying, "This project, I hope, will provide us a kind of ingredient list tailored to different regions all over the U.S. for best supporting birds in even quite urban areas." One of the study's central questions tests whether the luxury effect, the tendency of more affluent urban neighborhoods to host a greater diversity of plant and animal life, holds true in Durham. Alf suspects it will. "Durham is a pretty good example," he says, "of the luxury effect. A lot of these really nice neighborhoods downtown, like Trinity Park, that have pretty expensive homes, also have beautiful old willow oaks that have been there for 80, 90, 100 years, and they provide a lot of lovely shade. And in addition, they provide homes for a lot of foraging birds, so you have really lovely bird song in places like that." To collect data, volunteers travel to randomly generated coordinate points throughout Durham and then use the bird ID app called Merlin to record and identify birds based on their distinct songs. "It's like a game," Bunnell says, giddily scrolling through the list of species she's encountered. She pauses on the Prothonotary warbler, a round-bodied bird with brilliant yellow plumage and slate-blue wings. "I don't know how to say that," she laughs, gesturing at the little guy's stately title, "but he was literally so adorable." Now, folks, I'm just going to interject about Merlin, which is a free phone app on any phone platform. And I sit on my back porch and point it up, and it will listen to any bird song, almost no matter how far away, even that my ears don't detect, and it will tell me what it's hearing. And it does this all not with audio recording specifically, but with, in effect, voice print software. Anyhow, Merlin is one of a few of these ones, and it's very useful and informative. Okay. So anyway, some sampling sites like the Wooded Pond near Briar Creek, where Bunnell goes to record, share Trinity Park's tranquil green space. Others are marked by less natural hues, like the smooth orange of a Dunkin' Donuts drive-thru on Hillsborough Road, or the dull gray of an exit ramp off I-85. Ryan Campbell, a statistical geneticist who works in Research Triangle Park, notes the difference between the species he's spotted in the woods near his office and those at his sampling site in East Durham. Quote, "In East Durham, you mostly hear the common city birds, house sparrows, house finches, mockingbirds, the kind of species that thrive around people. But in RTP, the app picked up birds like the brown-headed nuthatch, indigo bunting, and wood thrush." Alf chose to use real-life volunteers instead of autonomous recording devices so he could gather data from more populated locations, without leaving the equipment unattended. In Alf's opinion, using people to sample birdsong benefits both his data set and the volunteers. And volunteers such as Courtney McGuire say they felt empowered by their contributions to the citizen-led project. McGuire, a public health researcher, recently lost her job due to USAID funding cuts. And she says, "To see the hits on science from our administration is just terrifying, right? And so the idea that community members can push back against that is a really low-cost way to collect data and be able to say something really important about the health of our bird species is really exciting to me." Alf also sees Concrete Chorus as a valuable opportunity to connect with nature. Quote, "One benefit that comes to mind is this idea of a sense of place, which is sort of the connection one feels to their local community and their literal local geographic space," he explains on the phone from his Colorado-based lab. That sounds, I know, it sounds silly at one level maybe, but I can tell you that even just listening to one snippet of a song really takes me back to North Carolina. McGuire, who is excited by a recent encounter with an Oriole, the namesake of her family's favorite baseball team, echoes that sentiment, and she says, "It's really been a good reminder for me to slow down in the morning to, like, turn off the news and just listen to some birds." All right, here's a the Ask Indy, which is a fairly new feature on Indy Week. And there are various civic-related and all sorts of questions over the few issues that has been published. This one, Ask Indy a question. What are Durham date ideas that don't involve alcohol? This edition of our Ask Indy column holds the distinction of being the first topic no one has submitted a question to. We take no offense. There's a lot more to ask of topics like, say, the Durham Public School System or Wake County Transit. Scrolling back through Reddit, though, it is clear that dates, how to get them, what to do on them, is something plenty of locals wonder about. "While I can't help you on the former," writes Sarah Edwards, "find some thoughts on the latter." One of the most frequent date night questions that surfaces on Reddit, what are Durham date ideas that don't involve alcohol? And here are some options. First, frozen treats. If you're going on a date circa now, you're both going to be sweating. You might as well make seeking out something cold the organizing principle of your date. It's a wholesome and relatively non-committal activity, so it's good for an early date. Go classic and get cones at the Parlor and then walk around downtown. Try Andia's ice cream at the Can Opener. Relatively private feeling with plenty of food trucks to choose from. Or get specific and grab ice cream sandwiches at Rose's Noodles, Dumplings, and Sweets, where standout flavors include white miso ginger snap and berry key lime sorbet on vanilla graham crackers. In my opinion, advice generally applicable to both ice cream sandwiches and dates, the more specific, the better. If you're looking for spots outside the downtown Durham core, where this Durham date will occur, walk over to Pistachio in Lakewood or Loco Pops near 9th Street. That one has a lovely screened porch that's good for really settling into a chat. Loco Pops also has another iteration off Foster Street. For a bit more of a commitment, drive out to the dreamy Broken Spoke Farm stand in Hillsboro for a soft serve on the weekends. You can bond with your date by trying to pet a goat or a cow. All right, so things are going well, and eating ice cream can reasonably only take so long. What's next? Depending on where you are in Durham, pop by a bookstore like Letters or The Regulator and browse. That's an activity that hits the perfect ratio between talking and silence. Or walk to the main library downtown. Swoon! Recreation. You can trust that this is objective journalism because I'm suggesting a category of activity, physical risk, that I probably wouldn't enjoy doing on a date, but many people do, so here goes. Go climbing, rock climbing at the Triangle Rock Club or the Durham Boulder Garden. Take a salsa dancing class at one of Durham's many dance studios or at the weekly Sunday Salsa Social. Sunday Salsa Social. A walk or picnic at Duke Gardens is a classic. You could also go over to the Museum of Life and Science's genuinely enchanting Butterfly House. Go roller skating at Wheels and recover with slices of pizza. Stock up on quarters and show off your Mario Kart skills at Boxcar Bar and Arcade, High Dive or Bolero. Bike or blade on the American Tobacco Trail. Okay, I might have persuaded myself. These all sound like fun. Another category, art. Each third Friday of the month, downtown Durham hosts an art walk. Galleries throw open their doors for browsing, and there's usually some kind of music happening outdoors. It's a lovely way to roam. People watch, support local arts, and perhaps grab a bite to eat afterward. Of course, the Nasher Museum of Art and the North Carolina Museum of Art, they're over in Raleigh, both occasionally have special evening hours. Romantic, but are also a good activity at any hour. You can have a coffee at the Museum Cafe afterwards. Downtown, this is Raleigh, 21C also has a collection that's fun to wander. And here's our list of summer exhibitions, and there's a link to that on IndieWeek.com. For more hands-on activity, you could take a class at the Durham Arts Council or Claymakers. Or go to Chapel Hill for one of Triple Spring Studios. Many class options like candle making, wooden spoons, or mosaics. Finally, hyperb-specific events. Let's hang out is the death of romance. Let's learn to play Mahjong, or let's go to the Nick Cage Film Discussion Group. Both upcoming events hosted by the Durham County Library are the birth, maybe, of romance. You can find events like these on the County Library website or Discover Durham. Of course, I'd be remiss not to plug our weekly Indie Selects series we publish that highlights five unique local events each week. The Carolina Theater has frequent events and special series like its ongoing retro film series. And there are always unique events at places like Metalsome, Shadowbox Studio, and the Pinhook and Motorco Music Hall. Unlike getting ice cream, committing to structured activity does have a higher buy-in threshold. But that's okay. In an age of relational evasion, a bit of buy-in is healthy. whether you've known each other for 20 years or 20 minutes. And with my remaining 3 minutes, I will venture back to the Best of Durham. Now, Independent publishes the Best of the Triangle Awards every year, and the Durham County is now in the books for winners, and the Orange County, I believe, in Chapel Hill area is the next to take nominations and vote. So it's a long list, and I'm just reading the winners in the Durham area in all kinds of categories, and here I go with about a minute left. Best alcohol-free venue is the Durham Farmers Market. Best arboretum or garden, Sarah Duke. Best bike trail, American Tobacco. Best working space, the main library. Best dance venue, the Fruit. Best golf course, Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club. Best park, well, West Point on the Eno. We'll have to wait on that one. Best hotel, the Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club. Best hotel lounge, rooftop at Durham Hotel. Best karaoke place and event is Pinhook. Best place to take a first date, Duke Gardens. Best place to take an out-of-towner, Duke Gardens. Best place to people watch, the Durham Farmers Market. Best sports bar, Bull McCabe's. Best summer camp, Schoolhouse of Wonder. Best trivia and bar event, Hammered Trivia at Dirty Bull. Best peace preschool and early education program, Schoolhouse of Wonder. Best chef, Carrie Schlieffer, Alley 26. Best DJ, DJAO, VIP. And best draft slinger, Tom Fisher at Queenie's. Well, folks, I always run out of time long before I exhaust the articles in the Indie Week. And so some of them never see the light of day or the audio light of day, at least on this program, but they're always available to you. IndieWeek.com is a free online publication. It includes links to many of the things which I'm not able to read over the air. And meanwhile, I will be back next week with the weekly edition of The Independent. And John Fetterson wishes all of you a humid, warm, which you're going to get, week. We'll be back next week. This program, aired Friday, will be then in our publication stash of podcasts. And we all hope you have an enjoyable week. We'll be with you again next time. Bye-bye.